It is 7:30, and time once again for Community Forum, and we are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning, John Ross. John Ross is an author, an activist, a poet, and a correspondent. He has written several works of fiction and nonfiction, and is the winner of the American Book Award in 1995 for the book Rebellion from the Roots, the first look at the Zapatista Rebellion in Chiapas. And he will be speaking today at Elliott Bay Books at 4 o'clock about his latest book, Murdered by Capitalism, 150 Years of Life and Death on the U.S. Left. John, thank you for spending time with us today.
Sure. Great to be here.
Let's start out. You are constantly on the move, it sounds like. We were talking about before we just went live that you are just returning from a couple of very important events, one, the G8 Summit, and then also some events that were happening in Turkey. Can you tell us about those?
Yeah, I actually was not at G8. I was there just before it and was there for a bunch of the planning meetings and kept real close contact with folks that were at G8. But I had a real good glimpse of what was about to come down. And putting it all together, I actually have a piece on Counterpunch last week on the Counterpunch.com that deals with G8 and basically entitled Jihad Meets G8, because we can't really eliminate the bombing factor. The London bombings really come on the second day of the G8 meeting. And in a real sense, all of the anti-globalization action that's taken place over all of these years was kind of paled by the bombing itself. But it's sad to say, the London bombings did, in fact, nullify G8. And it's one of the first times that an international forum has been nullified by forces other than their own dissension within. There were important demonstrations all around G8, beginning in early June and all throughout July, marches of hundreds of thousands of people under the banner of "End Make Poverty History." We had another one of Sir Bob Geldof's all-star concerts, kind of a celebration or a reincarnation of Live Aid during the 90s, which was dedicated to ending one of Ethiopia's many famines, where we had all the pop stars in the world. There was a lot of buildup around what happened in G8, and a lot of mobilization throughout all of Europe, and particularly in Scotland and Great Britain and England. But nonetheless, again, we see the forces at work here. You know, I have little doubt that the bombings that occurred in London are a reflection of this illegal war that goes on in Iraq. We have the Downing Street memos to tell us all about how the Blair government knew full well that there were no weapons of mass destruction. Nearly 100 British citizens have been killed in Iraq now as part of Blair's expeditionary force to provide logistical support for George Bush. And I think until this war is ended, until the U.S. troops are out, we're going to see this as the number one issue globally for lots of different constituencies, not just revolutionary Islam, but lots of different constituencies. And it seems to me that the Blair government is obligated to concede, at least, that its participation in the war in Iraq was at the root of the bombings that took place. There was a constellation of events, G8, the continuing war, other factors that entered into the bombings that took place. But, you know, this is an extremely serious situation, and the people at the top seem to have no inkling about what's going on out there in the world. The other event that I had the privilege of assisting at and presenting some documentation was the Iraqi War Crimes Tribunal in Istanbul. There have been over 20 panels developed along the line of Bertrand Russell's tribunals on American atrocities in Vietnam in the 1960s and early 70s. There had been over 20 panels. A lot of evidence had been accumulated. There were separate panels in Japan and Korea. So this was kind of the summing up session. But there were plenty of advocates to submit new information, including a great number of people from Iraq, people who have been witnesses to this slaughter. And it was really a very intense and heavy experience. It was almost like being in a black hole for 3 days, as I've said in a poem and a piece I just put out on Counterpunch this week, that really brought the war very much home. And the jury, excellent jury, headed by the fine Indian novelist Arundhati Roy, and a great number of other human rights experts all from around the world, including the lawyer for the Zapatist Army of National Liberation. I was quite proud to have brought Miguel Angel as a jurist to Istanbul. In a real sense, this was a political theater. We will submit the findings from the Iraqi tribunal, war crimes tribunal, to the International Criminal Court in Rome, but the U.S. refuses to recognize the jurisdiction of the ICC. This war is going to continue on for a while, I think. I am, the first guy to go to federal prison for refusing Vietnam. I actually got to Terminal Island Federal Penitentiary the night before Lyndon Johnson faked an attack in the Gulf of Tonkin on August 4th, 1964. So I am officially the first guy to be in jail. I was in jail when the war began, because the war begins at the Gulf of Tonkin. And I've spent, my life really dealing with this question of the imperial beast here and how it imposes its will on the rest of the world. So in a real sense, I hope we're not still on the Vietnam timetable, but if we take a look at that, we have 8 more years of this to go through and thousands of more U.S. citizens to be killed in the desert and tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of Iraqis who have already died as well. So began this crusade in 91 when I went out to Kuwait and into Iraq right after the first Gulf War to essentially help rescue some Palestinians that were being dispossessed of their property and deported and tortured after the first Gulf War and just before this war began. We traveled to Baghdad as human shields, and I think we actually our experiment as human shields had some definite flaws in it, but nonetheless, all of the public infrastructure sites at which we positioned ourselves were left untouched by Bush's bombings during the shock and awe stage of the war. So it wasn't too much in terms of trying to interpose our bodies between Bush's bombs and the Iraqi people, but we did, I think, for a while, preserve some of the infrastructure sites that were all civilian-designated sites by the United Nations. So we had some success. I'm going to try and talk a little bit about that and read from my new book at Elliott Bay this afternoon, talking about the human shields. It was, I think, an experience that changed a lot of us in terms of what our commitment was to ending this war and all wars.
So, in your book, Murdered by Capitalism, you cover the wide range of history here within the U.S. for the left. Can you give us what your sense is for kind of where we are currently? Are things better or worse?
Well, I think that a lot of the older people on the left, and I have to consider myself an older person on the left, although my heart is young, there's a lot of nostalgia that gets in the way of understanding that there really is a left in this country, and it just has to be looked at in a broader sense. It's not a left that is any longer a necessarily an ideological left. The left of the vanguard party has diminished. They're really, this whole question of having a group of people that know more than the people is, I think, been greatly diminished in these last years. And what I see really as a foundation to be built on is this whole movement that has developed around the anti-globalization demonstrations everywhere. G8 was indeed another example of this whole anti-globalization movement that is really globalization from down below, the globalization of resistance that began right here in Seattle, December of 1999. And I think, as I mentioned before, I was here for that, and really it was a great moment to see 60,000 people take over this town, defy, keep those delegates from the World Trade Organization from getting from the hotels to the convention center. I think there was a major logistical mistake made by the Seattle police. But we've never been able to do that again in any anti-globalization demonstration. We've always been kept outside, but, you know, Seattle made a logistical mistake here. On the march, I kind of looked around me at one point and realized that I knew many of the people that were on that march because we had met in 1996 in the Lacandon jungle in Chiapas, Mexico, when the Zapatista Army of National Liberation had called a meeting in defense of humanity and against neoliberalism. And it was there that I really learned about the World Trade Organization and what globalization was. And I think other people took their cue from that meeting, that first meeting in the jungle. And all of a sudden, there we all were on the streets of Seattle in 99, and I saw a lot of those same people 2 years ago in 2003 in Cancun, Mexico, when the World Trade Organization came to Cancun, and have seen a lot of those people actually all around the world on this last tour. And it's amazing to me that the poorest of the poor, this tiny little group of indigenous people in Mexico, Mayan people, the Zapatistas, have had such far-reaching impacts on a movement, and they're part of this whole new left, new left, you know, this whole part of people that have decided they need to create autonomous institutions, get off the grid, no longer depend on the government to satisfy their demands, because the government is not going to satisfy their demands, and even a concept, the old left concept of taking state power. Is, you know, a lot of people are saying, why do we want to take state power? The state doesn't function any longer. The state is just a business agent for, you know, transnational corporations. It's, you know, this whole concept of revolution as being defined by the taking of state power rather than building an alternative power. We have a tremendous model here working every day in Chiapas, and the Zapatistas continue to infuse me with a great deal of enthusiasm. I've written 3 books on them, and I'm working on a 4th, and they really do color my life in many respects. There's a wonderful new communique today from Subcomandante Marcos, in which he begins by saying, "You won't believe me, but I'm sharing my bread with a penguin." You know, there's always a sense of humor, and this is a rebellion with a great sense of humor. And a great sense of magic realism. Between the anti-globalization movement and having worked so long with the Zapatistas, really, I really do see a great deal of optimism in terms of the development of a left, a non-hierarchical left, a left that doesn't depend on these old stodgy theories of taking state power and having a vanguard party, but really works on its own.
So you have been extensively covering the Zapatistas and what's been going on in Chiapas for years. Tell us, how is it that you came to be there? And also, do you think that what they are doing there can really be exported or imported here in the U.S., that we aren't so ingrained with our current ideas and models that will readily accept that?
You know, just to answer the last part of that first, many years ago, in the first year of the rebellion, actually, the Zapatistas and government had a negotiating session in San Cristóbal de las Casas in the highlands. And we had an opportunity to meet with the comandancia, with the comandantes of the Zapatistas, extensively during that period. The negotiations went on for 3 weeks, and every morning we would sit down with the comandantes and with Subcomandante Marcos. And repeatedly we would ask him questions like, what can we do in terms of support? How can we develop solidarity with the Zapatistas? And I think more in exasperation at these constant questions, Marcos finally said, be a Zapatista where you are. That's the best thing that you can do for us. And I think that Zapatismo is entirely importable. it transcends borders. It's entirely global, but from down below. And it simply says, you know, we need to establish our own institutions. We need to be able to divorce ourselves from the states, from the political parties, which are certainly don't operate in our interest, you know. We need to develop some kind of political apparatus in this country, but it's certainly not the Democrats or the Republicans, you know. Doing stuff on our own for the communities, and always with this concept of mandar obedeciendo, to govern by serving the will of the people, by obeying the will of the people, essentially by serving the communities, you know. And this concept of doing service as a leadership principle seems to me most important and most importable for us here, no? My connection with the Zapatistas, I think at Elliott Bay, I'll talk a little bit about the origins of this today, but I've always been very much attached to indigenous and campesino struggles, farmer struggles, and all of the Americas. I've worked in Latin America for 40 years now. So I've always paid particular attention to those struggles, and I had word that there was a situation developing in Chiapas in 93, and spent some time in San Cristobal, saw some documentation, put some stuff together, and wrote the first article on the Zapatista Rebellion, actually in the summer of 1993, and it was published in October 12th, 1993, which we call Columbus Day here, but which all throughout Latin America is the Day of Indigenous Resistance. In this tiny, eccentric Northern California weekly, the Anderson Valley Advertiser, we scooped the world with this stuff. But it was pretty obvious that it was going to happen, and the reason the world didn't know that the rebellion was about to take place was essentially in 1993, in the summer and fall, was NAFTA time in the U.S. Congress. And both Bill Clinton and Carlos Salinas, then the president of Mexico, were dead set on letting any of this information get out. And a substantial part of my first book, Rebellion from the Roots, really deals with the cover-up of this developing indigenous rebellion. As the chief political officer of the Mexican embassy once told me, John, you know, if U.S. Congress had known this rebellion was about to take place, the 34 votes by which NAFTA passed would not have been there. So, their rebellion begins on January 1st, 1994, in the very first hour that NAFTA kicks in. And it always has had to do with this question of very much corn. The Zapatistas are people of the corn. The Popol Vuh, their sacred book, says they are made from the corn. And what NAFTA has done is flooded Mexico with tons, millions of tons of genetically modified corn, destroying the seed stock in Mexico. The Zapatistas saw this coming way back in 94.
And you were telling me earlier that one of the things that they're doing is saving those seed stocks now.
Oh, yeah. It's an interesting project amongst many other projects, but the Madre Tierra Seed Company has been, we've bought a freezer, and so we're freezing good Indian corn, pure Indian corn, to preserve the germ plasma. It's a defense against genetically modified corn, which is flooding into the country, 6 million tons last year. And also it's available for sale. If you look on the Schools for Chiapas website, www.schoolsforchiapas, you'll see the Madre Tierra Seed Company, and you can even order some of that corn if you want to do that. Just to remember what real corn looked like.
Well, Latin America itself is very inspiring at this point in time. There is a lot of countries there that are rejecting the U.S. economic model. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I think that, one of the only benefits of the war in Iraq has been that it's so obsessed the Bush administration in the United States that it has given Latin America a lot of breathing room and not spent a lot of time looking at what's going on in Latin America. So in this very brief period of time, we've seen governmental changes all over the continent. Basically, it's a function of a reaction, the kind of the pendulum swing away from neoliberalism, which said, in effect, what the people have is for sale, their transportation systems, their phone companies, their electricity generating plants, their petroleum, all of this privatized and handed over to transnational capital. And all over Latin America, the people have been disprotected in the sense their health services, very essential things that have been privatized and essentially cut back on what's available to them and what their access is to the system. So, and the new leaders in Latin America are not radicals or social democrats, but who understand that the state does have a function to play in terms of providing for the people. Probably the only function that it has is to provide for the people. So we see Kirchner in Argentina after the Argentinazo of 2002, which is this great movement from down below. Kirchner is not a particularly progressive person, but he has to govern in the name of the people because the movement down below, the picateros, the people that are the unemployed workers that have taken over factories, that movement is so strong that essentially they force Kirchner to take progressive actions, debatably, because the negotiation with the World Bank has been interesting, but not too fruitful. In Brazil, of course, we see Lula, and there's a lot of criticism of Lula as having sold out, as having not fulfilled his electoral promises. There's all of a sudden scandals within the administration. My sense is that Lula will run again and still has a 60% popular rating in the country, and will be during his next administration that we're going to see important changes made in Brazil. That's as much as he can retain office for the next 4 years. So we'll see that change. I think we'll see much more progressive actions and perhaps more antagonistic actions to the U.S. The Venezuela, I think, if folks know what's going on, Hugo Chavez is consolidating tremendous support down below. None of these people could operate without tremendous support down below. And we saw when the U.S. tried to displace Chavez in April of 2002, a million people gather at the Miraflores Palace demanding that Chavez be brought back. And again, very progressive politics, and again, trying to utilize what's in the state to provide for the people and to nullify this question of privatization. Also, I saw Hugo Chavez just take a very strong position against genetically modified foods as well, which kind of warms the cockles of my heart. Same thing is happening in Uruguay, and Tabaré Vázquez is very much along the line of a Kirchner, very much along the line of a Lula and Chavez. And, of course, the place that is just in tremendous uproar all the time is Bolivia. And I did a trip last year to Bolivia, Peru, and Ecuador, the three majority indigenous countries in the Indian heart of Latin America. And it's fascinating to see imprints of the Zapatistas, of the indigenous movement, actually, in those countries operating independently and sometimes in conjunction. And Bolivia is in constant uproar, but in constant uproar from down below. And if indeed the CIA and the DEA and whoever's in there allows Evo Morales to run for president in 2007, there's no doubt that he's going to be the president of the country. So I think all throughout, and we'll see the same thing in Mexico, if indeed Andrés Manuel López Obrador is elected president in the 2006 elections. He comes from a left-center social democratic party, the Party of Democratic Revolution, been a mayor of Mexico City for the last 5 years, and tremendously popular politician with a real feel for the people, and again, against privatization, against this whole neoliberal way of doing things. So that's a substantial amount of important countries in Latin America. I've seen a map that is kind of like that Bush, what was his name? The candidate Kerry map. That kind of Bush Kerry red blue map, except the red in this is the left, and it virtually covers all of Latin America. So, the benefit that the war in Iraq has done, it's so diverted the Bush administration from looking south that it's kind of too late for them, to tell you the truth at this point.
For those of you tuning in, we are talking with John Ross. He is going to be speaking today at Elliott Bay Books, talking about his new book, Murdered by Capitalism, a memoir of 150 years of life and death on the American left. John, getting back to one of my previous questions, you were saying that you saw the globalization movement as being inspiring. Again, do you see in the foreseeable future here in the U.S. any dramatic or potential dramatic changes in what we see on a daily basis in terms of political life? And
I think that change is incremental within this society, and this new left that I've been talking about is a building at this point. We don't have the kind of infrastructure down below that makes us entirely viable at this point, but that's in development. There is, as much as I'm not a partisan of the political system, voting is one expression, one strategy for at least expressing the will of the people. And what's really incumbent upon the left in this country is to develop a viable option to the Republicrats, or whatever the name of that party is that's been running the show for so long. You know, I was disappointed in the Green Party in 2004. I thought that they missed a golden opportunity. The Democratic Party accused Ralph Nader of stealing the election for Bush in 2000. That was totally untrue. The Dems lost the election. They didn't actually lose the election. They actually won the election. If they had asked the right questions in Florida, as we know, they won by 23,000 votes, according to Miami Herald. And but they laid the blame at the doorstep of the Green Party. That was an enormous amount of political clout that the Greens had at that point to say, okay, well, you know, Nader's candidate is worth an anti-war plank in the Democratic Party platform as developed in Boston. But I think we threw away a golden opportunity there to kind of mau-mau the Democratic Party into taking a stance against the war, you know. And in that sense, that's not just politics, because a anti-war stance by the Democratic Party would have gone a ways to ending this war, and indeed would have perhaps won the election for Kerry. You know, so many people were disappointed. My friend Sal Lando will always talk about the faith-based left, you know. The faith-based right we hear about. But the faith-based left, you know, a lot of people were out there saying, well, John Kerry, even if he says he wants to do a better job of winning the war in Iraq, you know, he's really against the war. And so, you know, a lot of people believe that he was just lying or not telling the truth in order to gain votes. And so But a lot of other people were so turned off by the fact that the Dems had taken no position on the war that they just sat home. And I think that was a real factor in losing, you know, that election. At any rate, we need to have a third-party option in this country. And I don't know if it's the Greens. I like the idea of the Greens, but whether or not there is enough political will and innovation to stimulate people and attract people to their side is still a question that's up in the air. All of this is a process. We're in transition, you know. But again, I'm quite optimistic about watching this thing develop down below. No, this is we're in the belly of the beast here, you know. And the belly of the beast is the hardest place to be. You know, it's the hardest turf to work on to try and change things. And it has to be incremental. And we reach certain points, very much like critical mass, you know, the bike rides that take place all over the U.S. now. And there's a change, for example, all over the U.S., all over Europe now. We have this movement called critical mass. People on bicycles saying, get out of your cars, you know, that have learned that you get to a certain number and you can begin to change things. Well, that's what we're doing, is trying to build critical mass in this country.
All right. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. I want to thank you for coming in today.
Okay, great to be here. Good to talk early.
We have just been speaking with John Ross. He is author of the new book, Murdered by Capitalism, a memoir of 150 years of life and death on the American left. And he is going to be speaking today, this afternoon, at Elliott Bay Books at 4 o'clock. and admission is free.